I'd like to introduce our speaker for this year. This year we've brought out Pastor Jason Walters from Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Vista, California. That's right near Escondido, right in the general San Diego area of California in Southern California. Our brother Jason is a 2006 graduate of Westminster Seminary, California, and of our Institute of Reformed Baptist Studies. You know who his co-elder is because he's spoken here many times. His co-elder there at Christ Reformed Baptist Church is Dr. Jim Renahan. Jason is a trustee of IRBS. He serves along with me on the administrative council of IRBS, and I think you're also on the membership committee. Any other committees? So that's enough for us, isn't it? That's plenty for us. So it's my delight to introduce Jason to us, and I hope you'll pay good attention this evening and in the subsequent lessons. So, brother, come and minister to us.
Well, good evening to you all. Very thankful for the invitation, and it's always a joy to me to be able to travel to our sister churches, get to know them a little bit better. Of course, hear of the famous hospitality in Texas, although you really didn't have to close the schools and throw a parade for me. It was nice of you. This is an exciting time to be in Houston. It's fun. I appreciate the mention of Jim Renahan. I feel like whenever I travel, I like that because people are wondering, who is this guy and why should we listen to him? Just equate me with Jim Renahan and you're fine. I get instant credibility that way, and I like it. Well, this past Tuesday, of course, at least for many people, marked the 500th anniversary of the beginning of the Protestant Reformation. If the beginning of the Reformation is to be kind of dated to the nailing of the 95 Theses by Luther on the Wittenberg church door, October 31st, 1517. That's something we don't need to debate right now. Even though Luther wasn't converted until 1519. But it's a close enough approximation, right? We're here. You know, we're just saying, great is thy faithfulness. And I mean, to think 500 years later, on the other side of the world, and here we are meeting and rejoicing in that same gospel that was recovered at that time. And, of course, because we do live roughly 500 years after the earliest days of the Reformation, and this is the time that we've chosen to sort of mark that, this fall, you know, much attention has been given in conferences, publications, to the Reformation and to the legacy of the Reformation and to the legacy of the Reformers. But one aspect of the legacy of the Reformers that, as far as I've heard, has not gotten much attention is that of missions. The Reformers and missions. Perhaps it's a subject to which you really haven't devoted much thought. Did the Reformers engage in missions? Were the Reformers missions-minded, as some people term that phenomenon? Well, as with any such historical questions, the answer to those questions, you know, were the Reformers missions-minded? Was the Reformation involved in mission? The answer is going to depend on who you ask. And the answer is going to vary widely. And typically, that answer is going to depend on the theological convictions of the person that you're asking. It's amazing how much theological convictions can shape our view of history. My interest in this subject really began years ago in college. I was raised in the home of a fundamentalist Baptist pastor. And like any good kid raised in the fundamentalist Baptist church, I went to a fundamentalist Baptist Bible college. That's what you were expected to do. My first declared major in that fundamentalist Baptist Bible college was missions. I wasn't even a believer yet, but I wanted to go into missions. And maybe we'll talk a little bit about that, the way that missions has been, I think, to its detriment, romanticized by many people. And we get a skewed perspective of it. By God's grace, a little bit later, I switched to biblical languages, and I'm very thankful for that. But I was a missions major. As part of my course of study, I took a history of missions class. And by that time, I was converted, and I had begun to develop a respect for the Reformers and for Reformed theology. And so I was a little bit disappointed and surprised when I read in that History of Missions textbook a rather sharp rebuke of the Reformers for not having any sort of missionary spirit or vision and not engaging in any sort of missions activity. And so I was a bit skeptical of that claim because I'd read the Reformers and I understood more of them at that point. So I decided to look into it myself. I read every History of Missions book that I could get my hands on. And every single one of them said the same thing. That the Reformers had absolutely no interest in missions, never engaged in any sort of missionary activity, and were often kind of very strongly denounced for that. In the midst of that investigation, by the way, I came across a very helpful article by Dr. Michael Horton, and I think for the first time became aware of the existence of Westminster Seminary, California, which is where I eventually went, not for Dr. Horton, ultimately for Dr. Renahan. But as I, again, read this over and over again, these same claims against the Reformers, I wanted to look into it a little bit more. And even just this couple of weeks ago, deciding to see if anything had changed in the literature in the last decade. I still can't believe it's a decade since I graduated college. But last decade, if anything had changed, I went to the Westminster Library and looked at every single History of Missions book that I could find in the Westminster Library. And every single one of them had the same claim as well. And we'll look at those in a minute, the same criticisms. Really, the nicest thing I found said about the Reformers in any of those was in a book that didn't even mention them at all. I guess the author subscribed to the philosophy, if you have nothing nice to say, don't say anything at all. I just completely ignored and skipped over the Reformers. There was nothing to say about them in missions. Well, in this is what I'd like to do with you this weekend, is just kind of see for ourselves. Look at what the Reformers taught, look at what the Reformers did, and try to maybe interpret it in a different way than some of these critics are interpreting them. And so tonight, in this first session, we'll really briefly just consider some of those criticisms that are leveled against the Reformers with respect to their alleged lack of missionary spirit. And then I'd like to make some initial observations about those criticisms tonight. And then tomorrow, I'd like to spend a session just looking at what the Reformers actually taught and actually did that might qualify as missionary work. And in our final session, I'd like us to reflect on maybe even some positive lessons that we can actually learn even from the Reformers about missions, lessons that might even serve to correct certain modern imbalances and skewed perspectives on missions that we have. So that's what we're going to do. I apologize because tonight is kind of just the negative stuff. Hopefully you're going to be able to come back tomorrow and hear more and we'll get to the positive stuff. But look at the criticisms, look at the yucky stuff out of the way first, and then respond initially, briefly, and then tomorrow look a little bit more positively at what we can learn from the Reformers. And by the way, because of time constraints, I really will just be focusing on Luther and especially on Calvin. There's much to say about the other Reformers of the age and some of their successors and things, but really just most of the criticisms are pointed directly against Luther and Calvin, so we'll talk about those. All right, so first up, the criticisms. At the very beginning of the 1900s, a man named Gustav Warnick published a history of Protestant missions that was kind of the first of its kind, sort of the first history of missions. I mean, there were some things before that, but that really was an academically respectable work. And received as such. But it really set the tone for everything else, all of the other histories of missions really that have been written since. Warnock was a professor of missions at the university in Halle, Germany. And if you know anything about the history of missions, you know that Halle was a center of much missionary activity. In the early 1700s, The Lutheran king of Denmark wanted to send preachers of the gospel to his colony in the east of India, and he couldn't find anyone in Denmark who wanted to go, and so he appealed to the professors at the University of Halle in Germany, and they responded, and thus began quite well known in the history of missions, the Danish Halle missionary movement. And according to some historians, tends to be them, that was the beginning of the Protestant missionary effort, right? There was nothing really worth noting before that point. That's what began it. And for really a couple of centuries, these Germans from Halle were heavily involved in missionary work. They were, however, they were Lutherans, but they were of a particular strand of German Lutheranism known as German Pietism. Pietism was a movement within the Lutheran Church, and here perhaps I won't be as objective in describing this as someone should be. But Pietism was a movement within the Lutheran Church that tended to emphasize the subjective aspects of the Christian faith and the Christian life over the objective aspects. Another way of saying this, they emphasize the individual and the personal, the private, and really over against the corporate and the public aspects of the Christian life. They were more experiential. Now, again, that's a word that can be used in a good context. Experiential Calvinism is a good term. But, you know, much like our modern evangelicalism, on the whole, very much focused on experiences and less upon objective truth and doctrinal truth. So much in common with modern evangelicalism. Varnek and some of his colleagues in Halle, all of them on this Pietist tradition, virtually invented missiology as an academic discipline. Really, there wasn't a science of missiology before this point, but he and a couple of his colleagues started it. In his history of Protestant missions, Varnek really wastes no time in criticizing the reformers. Within the first 10 pages, so again, it's the history of missions, so he goes back and he starts at the beginning. But within the first 10 pages in his introduction, he writes this: "We miss in the reformers not only missionary action, but even the idea of missions in the sense in which we understand them today." Key phrase. "In the sense in which we understand them today." But continuing his quotation: "And this not only because the newly discovered heathen world across the sea lay almost wholly beyond the range of their vision, though that reason had some weight, but because fundamental theological views hindered them from giving their activity and even their thoughts a missionary direction." End quote. So you can see that while Varnek did acknowledge some of the difficult circumstances and some of the historical context that the reformers found themselves in, really, he ultimately blames their theology. There was something wrong in their theology, as he puts it, that hindered them from giving their activity and even their thoughts a missionary direction. Now, we'll talk a little bit about Varnek's claims more in a moment, but let's hear from some others who have followed his lead. A man named George Smith wrote a short history of Christian missions that was designed as a handbook for Bible classes, so really for children, but for others as well. But in it, he claims that the reformers were missionaries only indirectly. And that's the title of his whole section on the reformers: "The Reformers, Missionaries Only Indirectly." And what he means by that is that the only way they served missions was by spurring the Roman Catholics then to increase their missionary efforts to try to make up for some of their losses from the Reformation. So interesting that he even considers what the Roman Catholics were doing missions. But he's Protestant. Similarly, in 1912, Alfred Mason writes in his Outlines of Missionary History that the reformers' lack of missionary zeal is, quote, "difficult of explanation," end quote. He praises the doctrinal recoveries that the reformers made, and so he understands they wrested a pure gospel back from the Roman Catholic Church and purified it. But he sort of mentions that only in passing. Now, even though he praises the doctrinal recoveries, he nonetheless argues, "But here a strange anomaly is found in the fact that there has been hardly any period in the history of the Christian church so destitute of any concerted effort to spread the gospel in heathen lands than just this period of Reformation. End quote. Likewise, 1920, Charles Robinson claims that, quote, nearly two centuries elapsed after the Reformation before the churches of Europe, which had the open Bible in their hands, realized that it was their duty to impart the knowledge of its contents to the heathen. Some of the leaders in the Reformation movements were so far from initiating missionary work abroad that they regarded all such work as useless or even wrong. He doesn't footnote anything, by the way. But that's a claim that some of the leaders of the Reformation not only thought that missionary activity was useless, but that it was even wrong. Maybe speeding up a little bit, in the volume on mission in the Pelican History of the Church, Stephen Neal writes in 1964, he was a bit more sympathetic toward the Reformers' circumstances, but still he maintains that they, quote, wasted their strength with honorable but blind and reckless zeal in endless divisions and controversies. So again, he sees all of the doctrinal controversies in between the Protestants as that just wasted all of their energy, and so they didn't focus anything else on mission. And ultimately, he concludes that, again quoting, when everything favorable has been said that can be said, and when all possible evidence from the writings of the Reformers have been collected, it amounts to exceedingly little. End quote. One last quotation, and this one more recent, from 1983, but the book was republished in 2004. Ruth Tucker, in her From Jerusalem to Irianjaya, she writes this, worldwide missions was not a primary concern of most of the Reformers. End quote. And then while acknowledging briefly, again, some of the possible historical reasons for this, she introduces her second of two paragraphs in the entire book about the Reformers and missions. She introduces that paragraph by claiming Protestant theology was another factor that limited the vision of missionary enterprise. And so the claim, not only that the Reformers didn't engage in missions, didn't really think or have a concept of missions, but that it was primarily their theology that kept them from being missions-minded. We should isolate what it is about the theology of the Reformers that these historians believe hindered their evangelistic zeal. It tends to boil down to three theological positions of the Reformers that these people believe hindered them from having any sort of missionary zeal. Number one was Luther's eschatology. The claim is made that Luther believed that the world was just about to end, that Christ was just about to return, and that therefore he assumed there was absolutely no point in spreading the gospel to heathen lands, because it was over, right? They kind of had their chance. Secondly, so it was Luther's eschatology. Second, it was Luther's and Calvin's supposed view that the Great Commission was binding only on the apostles, that the apostles had fulfilled the Great Commission in their own lifetimes, and that therefore there was no obligation on the church in the present to continue to preach the gospel around the world. And then thirdly, so it was Luther's eschatology, the Reformers, again, take on the Great Commission. And then thirdly, of course, you probably guessed, Calvin's doctrine of predestination, election, which, of course, as we all know, renders all human efforts or responsibility null and void. Right? Ruth Tucker asserts that the Calvinist doctrine of election, quote, made missions appear extraneous if God had already chosen those he would save, end quote. I'm sure you've never heard that one before, right? Yeah. Well, hopefully, and I'm sure it is, some questions are being raised in your mind about these claims, about these theological reasons. Thankfully, they're all very easily verifiable. You can read Luther and Calvin, and we'll do some of that tomorrow. But we'll turn our attention this evening for the rest of our time and see that not only these theological accusations are all patently false, but even that the claims to a lack of missionary activity on the part of the Reformers are also highly questionable. But before we get to all of that, again, that's where we'll go tomorrow for the most part, I would like to make some initial observations in response to these claims and to this common caricature of the Reformers' views on missions. All right, so that was the criticisms. Now just to make a couple of initial observations, setting ourselves up, hopefully, for tomorrow. I had to limit myself to just two initial observations, although that's deceiving because it's really kind of two categories of initial observations. The first is that these writers, these historians, I would argue, exhibit a lack of sensitivity to the Reformers' historical context. It's funny for professional historians, but a real lack of sensitivity toward the Reformers' historical context. There's a logical fallacy that historians commit all the time, and that people on Facebook commit even more regularly. I always have to dig at social media a little bit whenever I'm talking. But it's called presentism. Sometimes it's called the historian's fallacy, although technically that's a separate fallacy. It's a technical distinction. But presentism, it's basically a form of anachronism in which modern-day knowledge and ideas and values are sort of mindlessly imposed on figures or cultures from the past. It's this is what we believe now, and this is why we believe that, and everyone else should have believed the same way or did understand. They had all this knowledge. One example of this, and I don't know if this is too controversial. I don't know. I'm in Texas, so I'm assuming conservatism all around me. Maybe in California, I wouldn't give this. Definitely not in California. But one recent example, and again, if you disagree with me on this entirely, please just ignore this, and I'm just making a broader point to lead us to. Just one example, in my opinion, is the recent controversy and the increasing controversy around the celebration of Columbus Day. I feel like presentism abounds in that. I really don't want to get into it, and I don't really have an axe to grind in defense of Columbus. But at the very least, while some might have some reasoned and historically accurate objections to celebrating Columbus, at the very least on the popular level, people are evaluating Columbus entirely against modern standards, assuming that he behaved more abhorrently than any other European at his time would have behaved. Or than any other explorer behaved. If you know anything about the history of any of the explorers, you know that that's not the case. It's presentism. It's taking our values and stuff. And yes, I'll agree. From the standpoint of modern, Western culture and from the values and all of that, yes, what he and his men and what other explorers, every other explorer did, was abhorrent. But again, to assume that somehow he's some psychopath monster and behaves far worse than any other European man of his day would have behaved, it's just not fair to evaluate that. This happens all the time, especially on the popular level, where we take figures from the past, issues, institutions from the past, and we evaluate them through our modern grid and assume that everyone should have seen how wrong those things were just like we did. Again, I'm not excusing any of it. I'm just saying we need to be sensitive to it. And by the way, I oppose Columbus Day, but for a very different reason. I'm Norwegian, and the Vikings made it first, right? And I mean, I'm not talking about Leif Erikson. There were a few, colonies in the maritime provinces. I'm talking about the Kensington Runestone. Anyone have any clue what the Kensington Runestone is? Hey, there you go. We got a couple of people. Good. I'm getting way off track. But it's a runestone in medieval Nordic that was discovered in the 1800s, end of the 1800s, in western Minnesota. Western Minnesota. The proof that 100 years before Columbus, the Vikings not only were on the coast, they had penetrated all the way into the interior of North America. Now, again, some people think it's a fake, but I could recommend a really interesting read. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. It's actually the book. Now I'm getting really off track. The book, and I'm having to defend the Kensington Runestone to you. The book, if nothing else, it's a really interesting exercise in critical thinking and in evaluating claims and perhaps reasons why some people believe it to be false and other. It kind of takes a holistic view at it. So not just the history, the circumstances, discovery, geology, linguistics, everything, but just kind of evaluates it as a whole. And I think it sort of tips the scale in favor that this is actually legitimate. So I've been convinced. But anyway, where am I? Presentism. Yeah, so don't... we can't be anachronistic in our thinking and look back and assume that the way that we view everything is the way that others viewed them in the past or should have viewed them in the past. That's what I think has happened with many of these historians and the reformers. We need to show a little sensitivity to their historical context. Let's keep in mind even just the geographic and political situation that Luther and Calvin found themselves in. They lived and ministered, and you're going to have to go back to your 10th grade world history class to remember some of this, but they lived and ministered at the beginning of the Age of Exploration, when Europe was just beginning to become really aware of the Americas, of sub-Saharan Africa, of the Far East. How much did these discoveries by kings and their fleets of merchants and their generals, how much of those discoveries were known to the average citizen in Switzerland or in Saxony? I doubt it was as much as we would assume. Calvin and Luther, we know that they knew at least of the existence of some of these lands. Calvin and Luther both make reference to new islands that have been discovered, but they knew precious little else about them. Their world was Europe and the areas immediately around them. And what were the areas immediately around Europe? There were areas in control of the Turks, of the Muslims. And the really only interaction that most Europeans had with the Turks was in battle. Luther was much more conscious of the Turks than Calvin was, because Luther lived in Germany and he was closer to the front where these wars were facing. And the threat of invasion, the threat of Muslim conquest of Germany was very real. Luther at times would speak to those in his congregation and give them warning about how they should behave if they're ever taken prisoner of war among the Muslims. And by the way, he tells them that they should try to win them to Christ. but it was a very real threat. It was a very present danger to Luther and those in Saxony and on the sort of eastern side of Europe. But all of North Africa, all the area surrounding Europe at the time, other than water, was under the control of the Turks, of the Muslims. Beyond that, even in the Age of Exploration, that exploration was limited to just a few countries, European countries, each of which was very, very Catholic. You think about who controlled the seas at the time. Spain, Portugal. Again, remember back to your world history class. Remember the line of demarcation, that line that the Pope drew and split the world in two? And he gave right to any newly discovered lands west of that line to Catholic Spain. He gave right to any of the lands, newly discovered lands to the east of that line to Catholic Portugal. And we'll actually get back to this tomorrow, because it plays a part in some of the missionary endeavors of the reformers, that line was moved, and then it was discovered that part of Brazil actually extended east of that line, and that's when Portugal conquered and settled Brazil, which is why they still speak Portuguese to this day. But not everyone recognized the Pope's authority to do that, including the King of France. I mean, the King of France was still very Catholic, and we'll talk more about that, sort of the political situation within France at the time, too. And so France still tried to grab territories in the New World. But in essence, until the establishment of the British East India Company and the Dutch East India Company in the early 1600s, the seas belonged to Rome and to the kings that were subservient to Rome. And by the way, when the British and Dutch East India Companies were formed, some missionary activity immediately began, Protestant missionary activity, and Britain and the Netherlands at the time were Protestant. And so Protestant chaplains were sent and really did some great endeavors, even though that's past the scope of really what we're talking about here. But geographically, even both Geneva, which again is in modern Switzerland, Wittenberg in modern Germany, they were landlocked. They had no access to seaports. And even if they did, again, the seas were in control, the newly found territories in control of the Catholics. In addition to all this, the political situation of the reformers was consistently precarious. It really would have been understandable if all that they could handle was the maintenance and protection of their own lives and congregations. That they actually accomplished as much as they did is astounding, and as we'll see, is actually a rebuke to us still today. But Luther, in regular danger of his very life, having to be disguised or hidden away on multiple occasions, war was a constant threat, again, war with the religious wars. In addition to all of the, you know, practical problems that accompanied leading a church through complete reformation. Calvin, likewise, exiled from Geneva for 3 years. Even when he returned to his congregation, he had to endure frequent struggles with the government of the city as he labored to for the full reformation of his own church as well. But I have to admit at this point, it almost sounds like we're trying to make excuses, aren't we, for the reformers? The reality is that we don't even have to do that. Again, I have to prove that to you even tomorrow. But as we conclude this evening, I'd like to make one more initial observation. Not only do these critics of the reformers exhibit a lack of historical sensitivity, they also, I believe, are operating with a very narrow and modern definition of the word missions. Very narrow and very modern. This particularly is the problem with Warnack, but then it's just been perpetuated ever since he wrote and made that claim. It's amazing to see how just patently false arguments in history can be made in one source and then just be perpetuated. It happens all the time. It's really terrifying. But with Warnack, in the quotation that I read before, again, Warnack made a very important concession. He wrote, "We miss in the reformers not only missionary activity, but even the very idea of missions in the sense in which we understand them today." And Warnack, about 130 pages later in his book, betrays what he means by missions in the modern sense, his narrow definition of that term. He writes, "The conviction has gradually become clearer that the carrying on of missions by free societies is of divine leading." He's a pietist. You can make claims like that. "I had this feeling, God spoke to me," something like that. So he says, this is the carrying on of missions by free societies. What does he mean by that? By parachurch organizations. It becomes clear that's what he means. "By free societies is a divine leading and is to be retained as a blessing both to missions and to the church." But then he goes on, "Only the sound reciprocal attitude between the free missionary societies and the official church must be wrought out in preciser form." So he's very clearly talking about parachurch organizations. He's not talking about the official church, which in Germany is the Lutheran Church. And again, even problems with the idea of having an official church. But that's what he's defending. He's defending that it is God's will that missions be carried out by these free parachurch societies. And really, he's just arguing because of so much of the fruit, quote unquote, that he sees came from that rather than from other ventures. That's what he means by missions, the systematic sending of professional missionaries to non-Christian nations through organized parachurch missionist societies. That is what we're criticizing reformers for not doing. That's what they're criticizing. So you can see this narrowness, but I think it goes even beyond that, because ignore the whole parachurch society thing for now, because I think we can all agree that that's not biblical, and it's not ideal. It's not what we're called to do. Although, well, maybe that's not a safe assumption to make in this day and age. In fact, what am I supposed to stop? Okay. Don't ever say that to a pastor. Oh, boy. It's not a church in our associations, but a church that bears the label Reformed Baptist recently. That I was hearing a lot, they're constantly sending out church planters and many of them to sort of these unreached groups or the, you know, with that 1040 window, kind of in that area of the world. And it just seemed like every few months they were having another commissioning service for people. You know, they were sending out missionaries, they were sending out church planters to these places. And then they made reference to this organization that they were working with. And so I clicked and did a little bit of internet snooping and found out that it's this completely parachurch organization that gives people a 10-month course and then they're sent out. And I was pretty floored by that. I kind of assumed that everyone who at least, you know, kind of claimed to be Reformed would understand that that's a dangerous and difficult way to do things. And we'll talk more about that tomorrow. So I guess I can't really make that assumption sometimes, but I think with this church I can make that assumption. But let's just think for a moment. So set aside the whole parachurch society thing. Europe was technically part of Christendom at the time. But was it not a mission field on the very eve of the Reformation? Absolutely it was. And beyond that, you know, is there really any biblical distinction between what we tend to call home missions and foreign missions? No biblical distinction. Now, we make a pragmatic, practical distinction sometimes. But I think that we think of these things in completely different categories at times. And sadly, in ways that are completely different from our ecclesiology and from our view of the church. And this is where I think the Reformers can help us. Let me read you a quotation from Joel Beakey. Really writing on the same vein, he says, "Those who critique Calvin, saying his evangelistic efforts failed to extend to the foreign mission field, are quite unfair. After all, did not Christ command his disciples to begin spreading the gospel in Jerusalem and Judea, home missions, and then move on to Samaria and the uttermost parts of the earth, foreign missions? Obviously, the established church should be involved in both home and foreign missions, the established church. But we err when we judge one." So let me read that again because I interrupted it. Sorry, I always do that when I'm reading quotations. I'm still quoting Beakey here. If I look up, I'm making comment. There you go. "Obviously, the established church should be involved in both home and foreign missions, but we err when we judge one more important than the other. A genuine spirit of evangelism sees need everywhere. It does not fall prey to the worldly spirit that the farther from home, the better." End quote. The proclamation of the gospel to those who do not know it is simply the church's mission. And perhaps we need to use that term in the singular more than in the plural, because we should be meaning the same thing by it. On these historians' suppositions, the Apostle Paul would not have even really been characterized as a true missionary, would he? Right? I mean, he never left the Roman Empire. They all spoke the same language. They had the same culture. And surely, of course, that means that he had no heart of missionary or evangelistic compassion on, for instance, the Celts of northern Britain or the Parthians in modern Iraq. No, absolutely not. And perhaps even on a more fundamental level, what did the Reformation, what did the Reformers, by the grace of God, do but recover and expound a pure gospel that had been clouded and obscured for centuries? And there is no missions without the gospel. There's no missions without the gospel. That is the church's mission, the proclamation of the gospel. Without the labors of the Reformers, none of the subsequent Protestant missionary endeavors, in the more technical modern term, would ever have occurred in the first place. There would have been no gospel to propound. This contribution of the Reformers can't be glossed over, as many of these historians do. Oh yeah, we're thankful because they recovered the gospel, but they really didn't engage in what we think missionary work should look like. We can't gloss over that. They gave us the gospel. Again, by God's grace. It can't be glossed over simply because their efforts and activities don't fit our modern conception of official missions. As Dr. Horton observed in that article I mentioned earlier, he writes this, quote, "If one maintains that it's the Reformation, if one maintains that it was the greatest recovery of biblical faith since the first century, the Reformation constitutes the most remarkable missionary movement in post-apostolic church history." Amen. I agree. I'm sure that you agree with Dr. Horton. Now you know that I agree with Dr. Horton in that. But that's what, I mean, short of castigating the Reformers for failing to show missionary spirit, I mean, that's what we should be seeing that. They spread the gospel all throughout pagan Christendom. You want to call that home missions, which again, I don't even think technically fits the label of that. I think they did engage in, I'm getting ahead of myself, foreign missions. But it does, as Dr. Horton says, it constitutes the most remarkable missionary movement in post-apostolic church history. There's another similar fallacy that these interpreters of the Reformers commit, particularly when they read their writings. And I'm sort of prepping for tomorrow, the first part of tomorrow. But it's not right to assume that just because you do not see a particular word or term in someone's writings, that the concept or the idea that that word represents is not there. And I have a feeling that that's the superficial, facile way in which many of these people read. They don't see the word mission or missionary often enough in the Reformers' writings, and they simply assume then that it's not there, that they had no concept of it. That is a fallacy, an absolute fallacy. But even granted that such a word, if the Reformers used it, would bear the contemporary camp connotation, mean the same thing that we mean by it, the Reformers need to be read more carefully. Is the concept of missions present? Is the motivation for missions present? Is the necessity and the command of missions present? And I believe that they are. But that is our subject, part of our subject for tomorrow. In conclusion, really, despite these harsh criticisms of the Reformers and their alleged lack of missionary spirit, even just these initial considerations, I think, show that we should question such accusations. Sort of lack of historical sensitivity that these critics are demonstrating, and especially their narrow modern definition of what missions is. But while I do believe that these initial observations of historical context, definitions of terms, I do think that they're legitimate, ultimately I don't think they're even necessary. So you're welcome for wasting your time tonight. The fact is that the missionary spirit is very evident in the Reformers, not only in their teachings, but even in their practice. And so we really can just let the Reformers' words and actions speak for themselves. And Lord willing, that's what we'll be doing, and I look forward to discussing that with you further tomorrow. Thank you.